has been 19 days since I was on a panel at the inaugural Vancouver Podcast Festival. This is the Cambie Report. I'm Ian Bushfield. On this special episode, you'll hear the audio from my discussion on the panel Politics and Podcasting at the Vancouver Podcast Festival on November 8th, 2018 at the Vancouver Public Library. The Vancouver Podcast Festival was put on by Doxa Film Fest and many sponsors that you can find at vanpodfest.ca. This panel is moderated by Joseph Planta of the On the Line podcast, and together with me, Ian Bushfield, you'll hear from Alex DeBoer of the Seeking Office podcast and Charlie Demers of the Well Read's Literary Leftist Book Review. As always, if you want to help support Cambie Report and help us produce more content, become a supporter at patreon.com/CambieReport, and when you do, you'll get access to our special Slack channel just for patrons. We hope to have a new episode up for you soon. For now, enjoy this panel where we discuss politics, podcasting, and the Vancouver general election.
So I guess one of the things that all of you probably follow Alex's podcast, Seeking Office, and Ian's Cambie Report. I think it was hard not to follow you guys during this election campaign. I think we're all politically minded here. This previous election campaign, this municipal election campaign, I think would be a good place to start, and then we can talk about podcasting and the sort in a moment. The success, though, of Seeking Office and the success of Cambie Report, did that surprise you at all, Alex?
I guess it's hard to measure what the success is. I haven't looked at our feed burner lately to see actually how many subscribers or downloads we had, but it was more than I anticipated a month or so ago. So I guess it's hard for me to measure the success, but I was pleased with what I could tell it was, and the engagement and feedback I got from listeners.
But like Alex, Ian, you were able to get almost all the candidates in this last election campaign on both of your shows, right?
Yeah, that was the thing that was really interesting about success. So in raw numbers, you know, Cambie Report had 800 to 1,500 listeners on, depending on the episode, because I have no qualms about disclosing my download numbers. I'm not saying you do, Alex. Sorry, that was not a slight.
What are you trying to hide?
But what I found really interesting about Cambie Report is just, and what we didn't really expect when I started to pitch the idea with Patrick and Matthew, my co-hosts, was the level of discourse it would generate and the number of people who wouldn't just like be idle listeners, but be engaged. So Twitter and social media became so active for us, and people were listening, and then for a while people would like live tweet their reactions as they listened to a show, which is very weird because it's like 2 days after you released it and you're like, oh yeah, I said that thing. I hope I don't regret that. But then when it came to candidates, because we built up that modest following, and I think we really managed to bring in a lot of the traditional media, a lot of journalists. So people like Frances Beulah was on very early with us. I know she was super friendly both to me and to you, Alex. Justin McElroy and all the and Jen St. Denis, who then sort of gave us some credibility that when we went to candidates and we said, you know, will you be on our show? They all said yes during the election. During their initial period, we could not find Ken Sim for the life of us. But then the election started in sort of the fall, and he was like, yeah, I'd love to come on your show. And he was way more chill than I expected for a NPA-type business guy. And that was a lot of fun.
So their shows, Charlie, are politics day-to-day. Yours is monthly. Mm-hmm. Yours is a book read from an ideological point of view, right?
Yeah.
And so do you find online that there is, I don't know, the desire or the inclination of listeners, say, to want to talk about things from a certain political point of view?
Yeah, I mean, so my podcast is more, I guess, about political first principles than the sort of day-to-day machinations.
Current affairs,
Current affairs, yeah. I mean, we did have, so Christine Boyle, who was one of the successful city council candidates in this last election, she has been a guest on my show. And so if you wanted to hear Christine Boyle have an hour-long conversation about Wallace Shawn's most recent book, you could. I definitely find that people are, so for instance, what Ian was saying about the 2-day cycle of like finding that people are listening 2 days after you put something out. I mean, I'll get messages from people who are listening to
months
an
ago.
Episode from, you know, yeah. months ago, literally. And they can do that with a book club podcast. There have been a few that we've tried to do in sort of a timely way. So I have one that we'll be recording next week, which is with the guest would be Dawn Paley, who is a Vancouver writer who's she's been living in Mexico for a few years, and we'll be reading a book by Lopez Obrador just before he's sworn in. His inauguration is in December. So occasionally we'll try and peg something to a specific timeline, but for the most part, they're evergreen. And I do find that people, you know, we've gotten good feedback, but people are definitely listening on their own schedule.
What's the challenge, Alex, when you're having a candidate on, in terms of what you want them to say? I mean, you and Ian are responsible enough that you're not playing gotcha with these candidates, but I'm sure if they did flub, that'd probably be a good thing for you, right?
Well, I mean, I mean, definitely I did some accountability interviewing, so there was some sort of gotcha style attempts made in terms of, you know, holding people accountable,
right,
and like being prepared for their defenses on tough topics. But I guess the goal when having candidates on the show is to, you know, not just give them a platform to speak, but to challenge their ideas. And we didn't just let anyone, you know, be featured on the podcast. It had to be someone who was newsworthy, you know, and we wanted to challenge them on their ideas rather than just be like free advertising for them.
Was that something that you were conscious of when you'd invite these guests on your show?
Yeah, totally. I mean, none of the hosts on our show have any background in journalism whatsoever, unlike Alex works with the News Collective at UBC and has at least some, I'm assuming, training in what she's doing. We're just like three guys with mics that who run around and ask people to come talk to us, and they thankfully do. But I think what we've always tried to do is be fair. And so while we will take that same kind of approach to who we reach out to and ask, there were 21 people running for mayor. We approached 5 or 6, and we got 4 that we put out. I think we also interviewed Ian Campbell, but we didn't end up releasing his interview after he dropped out of the race, which was unfortunate because he was a really interesting candidate, but that's its own story. And so in the actual questions, we, especially with the mayoral candidates, we really just wanted to give them space to kind of figure out who they were, you know, give them a bit of color, get into some policy details, because you have that time on a podcast that you might not have in like a quick radio interview where they get 6 seconds or something, and really try to flesh out those ideas. And that was more and less successful depending on the politician. I found some like Hector Bremner, you can't shut him up. He loves talking about policy, whether you agree with his policies or not. Someone like Candy Stewart, though, really just wanted to tell you his story. And did you know Candy Stewart moved out here and was in a punk rock band? Because I heard that story a lot.
God, I had no idea.
Yeah. And so it's just kind of like all those different things and how each politician was approaching it. And with council candidates, we wanted to do much shorter because there were so many more of them. And there again, we just tried to get a couple interesting things in, and we really wanted to, and we really weren't trying to like gotcha anyone. We just, you know, wanted to meet some good stories and left it to the real journalists to do real journalism.
So in this day and age, Charlie, when we look at politics, now just in the municipal level, because we were days from October 20th, do you find that a lot of the issues, a lot of the narratives that came out of that election campaign were on sort of the left-right spectrum, that they were looking at those things, or was it really just issues day to day, like how much we had to pay for taxes or those sorts of day to day things that citizens, I guess, are worried about in this town?
Yeah, I mean, I think that left right distinctions are always a fairly important part of anybody who's, The single thing you can say to make me most suspicious of your politics is that you've moved beyond left and right, and you're like, that's usually just means that you're like some sort of fascist. But one of the really interesting things in following this last election, which I didn't do so much on the podcast, but my wife Kara Ng is one of the co-founders of One City, and so I'm obviously getting a lot of this information from her, but it seemed to me as though the left-right spectrum was of almost equal importance to a sort of YIMBY-NIMBY spectrum, or a urbanist versus conservationist sort of approach. And so you really do, I think, in Vancouver right now, there really are four quadrants where it's like people, there's left and right, but it's also, you know, building up the city or keeping it more or less the way it is. And that second axis seemed almost as important in terms of what happened in this election.
I just want to toot my own horn here, because I feel like that was my fault, that whole discussion, in a way. So we had this one political scientist, Stuart Prest, on the podcast, and he sort of starts talking about this idea that traditional left-right issues aren't the biggest issue or the biggest dividing line in this election. And we have a Slack for the patrons of our podcast, and that's built up this really strong community. We have about 85 people in there now, and a bunch of people were toying with this idea, and I said, what if we put it out there as a test of, like, where would you put, you know, One City versus the Vancouver Greens versus the NPA and all these other municipal political parties that people don't really know what they stand for, but ask our semi-informed listenership, where would you place them? And I ran that as a Google survey, and suddenly it became, we got, you know, a couple dozen responses, enough to not make statistically significant positioning, but we managed to actually create that chart.
Yeah.
And that chart took a life of its own and became something that, like, the Globe and Mail republished. And I was like, I just did that in Google Forms one afternoon.
Right.
So that was the weirdest thing I think I had happened during this entire process of this podcast.
So Alex, is it a class thing then?
Sorry?
Is it, I mean, if we've gone beyond left and right, is it really people with money and without money that are sort of debating the issues? Or are we looking at issues in the city through that frame, say?
Yeah, I mean, I think class plays a big factor, definitely. But I'm not sure. I think that on the left, though, candidates may be very, I don't want to say progressive because that doesn't mean anything anymore, I guess, but very, you know, politically left, into wealth redistribution, etc. There's social justice values. There's still a distrust of developers, regardless of whether they're developing in order to build more social housing or whatever. So that's why, for example, like on Ian's graph, Cope was, you know, very different than One City. While they're both on the left, one is in favor of densification, the other is more in favor of keeping the city generally as it is.
Now, the other narrative that came out of October 20th was the idea of race, and because of the council was not as diverse as, say, the city was.
Or even close.
Right. So is that something that you're hearing a lot of?
Yes.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I hear it on my Twitter and read it on my Twitter and Facebook. What have you heard in terms of how to address that? I mean, the mayor cited that as one of his priorities over the next 4 years. What place do people online have, say?
Yeah, I think the three of us are a little hesitant because sitting here sort of white people being like, yeah, well, I'm going to tell you about race in Vancouver. But let me tell you about race in Vancouver. These are conversations that from the start of Cambie Report we were very aware of and sensitive to. And even though we weren't sort of all social justice warriors or anything like that, we just wanted to make sure that we weren't just talking from a male, whatever point of view. And we'd try to bring on people of color and women to get those different perspectives as much as we could. And I think we did a pretty good job through our coverage, and have heard from people tell us we've done a good job. So I'm not just trying to be self-important about that. The challenge is so multifaceted because the conversation for so long in Vancouver has been about foreign investment, and in some ways that is coded anti-Chinese language that goes back a century in this town and more. But in other ways, there is also a lot of global capital floating around, and trying to distinguish what's the problematic take on it versus what's the can move us forward gets tough. One of the parties that I've been super critical of, and that has now been super critical of me in calling me a Charlottesville protester because I'm so racist, mm-hmm. Is pro-Vancouver. And they ended up getting almost no votes. 6,000, I think, was one of their top candidates on council. And they were running 8 out of 9 people of color. But when you looked sort of at what they were talking about, they were really obsessed with foreign investment, mm-hmm. clamping down on developers. When you sort of probed their approach to intersectionality and these equity issues, which we worked with people of color to actually develop a survey and put out there, the answers were not as deep as, say, one city who well thought through these, COPE, Vision, these parties that have really thought it through. Even NPA, to some extent, has put more thought into this. Like, the mayoral candidate for pro-Vancouver told us in terms of how should we make sure that the wealth generated from the land value increases in the city is shared with Indigenous people. And he said, well, I don't think, or in my experience, a lot of Indigenous people aren't good with money. Mm-hmm. And
Jesus Christ.
But I'm the racist because I pointed this out. So it's a challenge, right? And I don't know what the solution is, because you look at the NPA and they had a Chinese Canadian running for mayor and he almost won.
Yeah.
But I wonder what the conversation would have been, because no one really talked about him as a person of color in that race. He was just kind of the NPA candidate.
Right. And he was resistant to that as well.
Yeah, I think
bringing race into it because of their voter base, I think.
And I think Shauna was resistant to wanting to be the female candidate.
I don't know. She definitely at the end was
right.
Was talking about how that would be important. But I mean, like we were talking about earlier, it's about like, how do we achieve meaningful diversity versus tokenizing diversity? As Frances Beulah said on one of our episodes of Seeking Office, like when the NPA was even stronger than it is today, they would have more diverse candidates, but they were putting those on to create a certain image of themselves rather than those people generally being like leaders of the party. And so, like Ian said, it's a multifaceted issue. How do we give opportunities to people of different, you know, genders and ethnicities and whatever, so that they can sort of like organically rise to positions of power rather than being placed there for optics.
Charlie, you're offline, right? You're not on Twitter and you're not on Facebook.
And yet here I am at podcasting. Pretty good.
Yeah. Did you seek podcasts during this campaign for news, say?
I mean, I feel like podcasts are one of the only ways in which the promise of the internet gets borne out in a positive way, where it is about the lowered barriers to entry and the lack of gatekeeping is actually, you're still able to put out something thoughtful because you don't have to fit it into the, you know, so Twitter opened things up, but mm-hmm. it's hell. Like, it's just hell.
You get called a Charlottesville protester on Twitter.
Yeah. But I mean, like, the crazy thing about that is, like, how is Charlottesville protester even, what do they even mean by that? Like, it's just, in every other way in which the internet was supposed to be this big boon to democracy, it's just, like, screen grabs and glib, like, and I find that podcasts are the one, because nobody can do, like, a screen grab of your podcast dialogue and take it out of context. I mean, they can quote you in a tweet or whatever, sure. But it just doesn't have the same effectiveness of like, I find that it's one of the only places where you can have a sort of honest and intelligent conversation. And set up some sort of parameters for who you're having the conversation with. So in terms of like, was I using podcasts to, I will state unequivocally that I received 100% of my election information this year from Kara, from my wife. It was also about 800% more information than I wanted about the election.
Sure.
I was not in the Ing Demers household. You don't have to go out looking for like
for news,
what's the scuttlebutt on the municipal election. It was 24 hours a day. I was already more engaged than I wanted to be. But I find that in general, whether it's American podcasts or Canadian podcasts, I find though that's a level at which I feel edified rather than stupefied by engagement on a weekly or day to day or monthly level.
So was that I guess the lack of municipal coverage, was that one of the reasons why you created Seeking Office and Cambie Report?
I don't think it was a direct response to the lack of local coverage, though it is said that, you know, there's less money for local journalism, and there is. But it was, for me, Seeking Office was a response to a lack of innovative storytelling and news coverage. I think that a lot of the major, or not even major, but a lot of the news outlets people go to for news, which did a really good job of covering the election online and like on the radio and such, don't have storytelling that's more like complex and dynamic and engaging, such as documentary style audio news coverage. We were really interested in providing sociological context, historical context to events happening in the news. Like, we did a little series, part one, part two, called How We Got Here, which is like, how did we get to this political landscape? You know, how did Vision come to dominate Vancouver for the last decade? Where did they come from? You know, is like a party that moves to the middle and our centrist politics more generally where we come together or where we lose ourselves? You know, like, it, I guess Seeking Office to me was a response to, a lack of more engaging audio storytelling on like current affairs topics.
Well, and for me, my first podcast, Politicoast, actually came out of exactly that. In October 2016, my friend Scott and I were basically just talking politics at the bar all the time, and we're like, I guess all millennial males at this point, and like, we should record this and put it on the internet. And that became a podcast. And we did so in a way that it gained its following, and we were having fun doing that, and it was growing and doing well. And then Scott decided he wanted to get involved in municipal politics. So we're like, all right, we won't talk Vancouver anymore because of conflict and bias, and he wants to be more involved. And so I said, well, I do want to, I think it's going to be an interesting election. And there's still conversations to be had, these sort of casual, just friends talking kind of conversations. And so I reached out to a couple other guys. I reached out to guys to launch Cambie Report. And that's where that kind of came from. And I think Alex is right. There actually was a good amount of coverage of the Vancouver election. I mean, you had Frances Beulah still sort of, she's in retirement in a way, but not. Mm-hmm. She's just always covering stuff, talking. The Star Metro has actually expanded its newsroom in the last couple of years since Star bought out Metro. And CBC actually did a lot. Justin McElroy's Metro Matters newsletter became a really valuable tool of tracking everything. And Justin's such a tireless journalist that people have to keep telling him to take breaks. And he jokes about that all the time. And so there was a ton of good content. And if that didn't exist and that coverage didn't exist, my podcast wouldn't exist, because I don't do a lot of original reporting as a podcaster. I just more kind of synthesize things and try to express my values through that and interview some people who are willing to come and talk.
So one wonders then, if there is such interest, why voter turnout was and is notoriously so low. Charlie, do you want to?
I don't know. I mean, it's it always has been.
Yeah.
I haven't looked at the. I mean, I do a books podcast, so I'm not super plugged into. But I haven't looked at if the. It used to be that the west side of the city really showed up and voted in quite large yeah. numbers, and the rest of the city didn't. And you know, we do have this. Vancouver politics is a weird thing, right? Because you've got a city where that's extremely diverse with an all-white council, except for one councillor. Mm-hmm. You've got a city that's more than half renters, where I think there's only one person on the council who doesn't own the house where they live. You've got we have a weird at-large system that people have tried to challenge over the years. I don't think we have a particularly representative. Council should be a lot bigger than it is. It should have some sort of mechanism for neighborhood representation. There should be some. And when you have a system like that. That people don't feel the results are representative, there's then a vicious cycle that starts up. I mean, I feel like, I forget what I was going
to
say.
Yeah. So far more people voted than listened to, I think, all three of our podcasts combined. So there was a niche interest,
yeah.
but I don't know if it was a wide interest. And I think Charlie hits on a couple key points there as well. When you went in and looked at that ballot, in reality, it was big and confusing, even as someone who is highly informed. And I think we were talking about this when you had me on Seeking Office, Alex. It's just like, how does someone who doesn't know Vancouver politics get into it? And I basically ran a podcast for 6 months, almost weekly. And that would be my suggestion, is like, that's about what you need to know to understand Vancouver
and
politics.
Everybody else in the city just ran for city council.
Yeah.
And that's, I remember, like, that was the thing I was going to say, was yeah. it was mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Like, you were just, you didn't even have a sense of, so a guy who used to run, like, I'm a comedian, a guy who used to run these open mic comedy nights ran for city council. And he was the first name on the... And so all these comedians were like, holy shit, Marlo Franson might get on city council because they did this random name generator and he was at the top. And I mean, that's a pretty depressing... Like, that in Vancouver politics, there's like this, oh, your last name starts with B. You were meant for democracy. Like, that's not a good sign.
Alex, in your reporting, are you hearing, people talking about wanting to change the system to make it, say, different the next time around?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, Elections BC is going to be looking at how these new campaign finance rules that were implemented provincially affected municipal elections across BC. I mean, there have been critiques of how easy it was to run for council and for mayor, and suggestions that, in fact, we should charge more to run for office.
And the deposit. Yeah.
The deposit, and to have more signatures required. Mario Canseco did a poll on this, and like a lot of Vancouverites were in favor of making it harder to run for office. So, I mean, it's both a nightmare and a dream, I guess, in terms of people being yeah. able to run for office so easily. I would say ultimately, though, it is a nightmare because I do think the long ballot affected voter turnout. It definitely did. And I don't know, from covering this election, I do think that people being confused and like paralyzed by information or just names and parties, it doesn't enhance democracy. But yeah, and in terms of like our electoral system being at large, I mean, Kennedy Stewart has said that I believe he wants to implement wards, right? He said that, right?
This is the worst promise of the entire election.
Yeah.
He's going to change Vancouver's election system. Yes. how he's going to do it depends on what you vote for in the provincial PR referendum. Right. Mm. If you vote for PR provincially, he thinks that means you like local PR, which is a different question because they work differently. If you vote for first past the post in the city of Vancouver, he'll just move us to wards. So either of them are better, but basing a local decision on a provincial question is a very bizarre promise that I critique. We all critiqued very heavily on my podcast because we're like, why? I guess he just doesn't want to run another referendum and he didn't want to commit to anything.
Yeah.
That sounded really harsh. I actually like the guy.
But I also love that the federal politician's response is like, I'm going to split the difference from provincial, municipal.
When you were last on my show in the spring, when you're, what were you promoting? Your new book?
Yeah.
I forget now what guests talk about when they come on my show. That shows where I am. You talked about not being on social media. I've alluded to that already, not being on Twitter, not being on Facebook. When Ian was a guest on Alex's show, they talked about, I guess the question that you posed, Alex, to Ian was whether it was useful to be on Twitter, to be on social media during an election campaign like this. And what was your response?
I think I just thought for a second and went, no, it's kind of awful.
Useful as a candidate or useful
for the average voter?
Right.
Yeah.
I said, no, yeah, the conversation on Van Pauly is just so toxic at times and so, like, people yelling at each other whether they want houses or don't want houses, whether it's foreigners or not foreigners. And it's just like, there is a lot of good people out there. But then there's also just all this toxic stuff that we've alluded to multiple times.
But it's like if you're into municipal drama, it's great. So if you're nerding out hard on like Van Pauly,
keep yourself out of the...
It depends what you want. Yeah.
Target.
So, yeah, if you can stay clean.
So as a result, does it dissuade you from continuing on social media or just you're far into it that you need to be on there?
I enjoy it in a way. Yeah. So, I mean, you like Alex is saying, if you like the drama or if you can sort of handle that, if someone calls you a Nazi, just like brush it off because, I mean, like maybe reconsider your life choices for a second. But if you're confident that people still respect you who aren't trolls on the internet, it can be valuable. And like promoting the podcast is valuable on Twitter and social media, and it's where I managed to have a lot of great conversations. But honestly, I get more value out of like the Cambie Report community that's on Slack than I do from Twitter some days. Other days, I just like being a snarky asshole on the internet.
Yeah. So you're still off, and that's going to stick, right?
100%, yeah. It for sure cost listeners. Like we, you know, the podcast did go down in per episode downloads when I got off Twitter. I was outside more when I was doing meth. Like, you know, I'm not, it's certainly not enough that I'll get back on fucking Twitter. I don't know. I just feel like here's the thing that we've had it for 10 years, and it's just, in 10 years, Donald Trump was the president. Like, it's just, it's a totally a bad thing. And I feel like we'll get to a place where we think of it like cigarettes.
Well, we'll see, I guess.
Yeah, no, I mean, Charlie's
an optimist?
No, I am an optimist in the sense that, like, I'm off Twitter and Facebook and I'm just, like, absolutely a happier person. And I read more and I spend more time. Like, I mean, there's no... And I don't say it as a judgment of... I'm comparing myself to the me that was on Twitter. I have more faith in human beings. Like, I just... There's no... When Ta-Nehisi Coates got off Twitter because... He was having an argument with Cornel West, and he was being criticized by Nazis and by left-wing feminists, he said. And he's like, I'm catching it from Nazis and from feminists. Forget it, I'm out. And his sort of like, I thought that was a glib way of putting it, because he was sort of trying to make the feminists feel bad that they were coming at him with Nazis. But what it really is it's a bonkers way of having a conversation. Eldridge Cleaver and James Baldwin never had arguments where the Klan got to weigh in real time. Like, that's fucking insane.
See, now we all have the idea of wanting to create these fake Twitter accounts.
You know, right, yeah.
Doing it in real time. Alex, when you look at this past campaign and you look at the use of social media, there were some candidates who were very active on social media. Did they do as well as, say, candidates who actually weren't on social media as much, say?
I don't have any like data on that, but candidates did better if they were in parties. So that seems to be the way people voted. There was not a single independent candidate elected to city council, park board, or school board. And yeah, for mayor, I mean, Kennedy Stewart was independent, but sort of in name alone, like he's NDP, right? Who's an NDP MP. So I don't really have any stats on that. I mean, Pro Vancouver was like probably the most prolific on Twitter, and they certainly didn't do well. So I think party recognition was how people voted.
Yeah, as far as I could tell, social media didn't really make much of an impact in the final result. Because I think the thing, it's so easy to get lost in when covering municipal politics so intensely, is most people don't. And most people don't look at this and they don't think about this. They just kind of, like Charlie, hear from someone that, oh, this is who you should vote for. Or they're like an NPA household that just always votes mm-hmm. NPA because they own a mansion in South Vancouver and they want to keep that mansion in South Vancouver, and that's what they're going to do. So they vote for that and just kind of go down the list. And
So door knocking and Burma shaving, those things really did count on?
I think that did help some of the parties. Like One City, I think, was yeah. really out there getting its name out, trying really hard, because to come from, you know, having only one run once or twice yeah. to actually getting someone on council does take a lot of work. Cope could rely a bit on name recognition mm-hmm. and Gene Swanson's success in the by-election, for example. Mm-hmm. People really didn't like Vision this year, mm-hmm. it turned out. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there was a few people who voted for Vision, but even their like Heather Deal, who was like their mm-hmm. one incumbent who yeah. was running again, got, you know, did not get anywhere near the bottom of the council ballot. So mm-hmm. NPA relied on name recognition.
Yeah.
Greens relied on name recognition a lot.
Yeah, I mean, the Greens rely on... I mean, we were talking a little bit about this before. Like, Greens, they can't do anything to change what people's perception of the name recognition is. You can vote with the NPA on school board for a whole term, and people are still like, oh, you know, the Green, the lefty Green Party, because it's called the Green Party, right? One City, you know, I can say, having been very close to the sort of nerve center of the campaign, their number one biggest challenge was people hadn't heard of them. So people really liked the policies if they heard them, but nobody knew who they were. Cope has been around since 1968, and had very high name recognition, also had some very high negatives because people had their name made up about them. So I don't know if you can say sort of blanket social media is good for candidates. I think it depends what the particular challenges of a given campaign are. Yeah.
We're going to wrap up in just a sec, but Well Reds will be back when? It's monthly.
Yeah, it's so we. I'm gonna have to do a stutter step because for the first time, we made it almost 2 years without any scheduling hiccups. But there was a misunderstanding with the guest that I have on. The problem is I have a pretty high ask for my guest, which is that they read an entire book and show mm-hmm. up ready to talk about it, and it's and it's not their book. So it's a, you know, it's a triangular conversation where me and someone else are reading a book together and talking about it. And so the person that I was having on didn't realize that I needed them in October. And so I'll be recording two episodes in November. So mid-November should be when the next episode
comes out. And Seeking Office, the last episode I heard was with you and Francis. Will it be back?
Yeah, that's something I need to figure out. But yeah, I think there are going to be a few more episodes. Yeah, I'll have to... We're on like Facebook and... I'll post an update.
All those awful social media sites.
Yeah.
I really don't mean it in a judgy way. No, no.
And Cambie Report, will that continue?
Yes, we recorded an episode on Monday after we went to the first council meeting, which was such actually a lovely affair. Everyone's very friendly on this new council for now. We'll mm-hmm. see if that lasts. We're planning to put out fewer episodes or less regularly than we were during the election when I think at one point we had something out every day in the last week. Roughly. Wow. Well, with so many interviews, we're just dropping things left, right, and center. But we're hoping for like one to two current affairs type episodes a month, plus a deep dive or panel or some other kind of discussion that we're hoping to continue these larger conversations that kind of got missed in the horse race stuff during the election. And with Politicoast, even tonight, we're going to be recording after the PR debate that's happening between John Horgan and Andrew Wilkinson. We're going to be hosting a little party over at the Drive Coffee Bar if anyone wants to skip the Podfest Festival parties tonight. We'll probably be pretty busy, so don't worry if you can't make it, and we'll put that out. That podcast has been weekly except for 1 or 2 weeks since October 2016.
And I so appreciate everyone turning up to listen to us talk about this, and I think... the folks at Van Podfest for hosting us, and the panel. Thank you all.
Thank you, Joseph.
Thank you.
Thank you.